May it please the court. My name is Brett Lilly, registration number 25662, and I represent the appellants, Telecom Resource LP and Jeffrey Wright. I think if you take a step back and look at this case from an overview, it's really a default judgment for over $1.3 million that was essentially entered as a discovery violation. But the city and the trial court, and this is their right, took the opportunity to sort of do an end run around the summary judgment issue and the normal discovery procedures by means of a motion for summary judgment. And again, while this is their right to do so, I think in these circumstances, asking for and being granted summary judgment related to alleged failures to answer discovery is subject to a sort of collateral attack on these discovery issues, as opposed to the normal de novo review that you have on summary judgment. Here we have the underlying issue, the trial court and the city essentially taking a shortcut through the discovery issue by means of summary judgment. And when you consider that in this light, that it's essentially a default judgment entered as a discovery sanction, I think reversal and remand is required. The first issue I want to touch on is whether or not there was receipt of discovery. And I think what really stands out when you look at the order again, getting ready for oral argument, is that there are really no findings entered by the trial court on this issue. Obviously, had she believed Mr. Mitchell that he did not receive the discovery, the outcome would have been different. But she did not believe him, and it seems from her order she didn't believe a word he said. And moreover, she thought his response of pleading was inadequate because he did not submit an affidavit. And on page 4 of her order, which is, pardon me for a moment, page 442 in the record, she just simply says that she rejects this argument that it wasn't received. Well, this raises the question, why? I mean, there's no real findings made as to Mr. Mitchell's credibility. She didn't have a hearing, which I think is an important issue when you evaluate the case law, particularly Moses and the Greinberg case. You know, at least the courts there held a hearing and kind of figured out what was going on. But whether she had a hearing or not, there's no findings whether Mr. Mitchell is credible or why she doesn't believe him. And I think that's an important thing to consider when you're dealing with the mailbox rule, because it's a presumption, right? I mean, I presume the city's going to say, well, if you contest the presumption, the trial court has to make findings. Well, that's the point. She didn't make findings. So at the end of the day, I think we're really left with a presumption of receipt. And again, on the hearing issue, I think this is important because there was not only was there no opportunity to observe credibility, but there was really no effective opportunity to rebut this presumption. And when we're dealing with presumptions, I think the opportunity to actually have your say is an important part of that process.
Counsel, of course. Did you request a hearing?
I don't believe there was a request in the record, Your Honor. But I think to that point in general, when you're first of all dealing with admissions that are allegedly not answered, on top of that, you're dealing with a pattern of behavior, I think you could say, that was apparent not only to the court, but probably to the city as well regarding Mr. Mitchell's behavior. I think it was appropriate for the court to maybe take control and sua sponte order here at that point. And to fill in that a little bit, I think the court's frustration and perhaps the city's frustration with Mr. Mitchell is probably evident and maybe understandable. But at the same time, that's not an excuse to punish the client, which is the reason you have a hearing and determine who's really at fault here. Is it the lawyer? Is it the client? Is it both? What's the situation? Did the client know that the discovery was received? Did the client ever actually receive the discovery? There's no findings on that either. And I think even when you're faced with conduct of counsel of this nature, it's the obligation of court and even opposing counsel to sort of raise the bar in terms of your performance a little bit and make sure that substantial justice is done for the parties.
Mr. Lilly, I think Judge Gilman also said that the response here was not done by affidavit, and you mentioned that yourself. Isn't that required by the rule?
I think you can read the rule in that sense, and we're talking about Rule 56.
Yes.
First of all, she just merely, all the trial court says to that point is that he did not submit an affidavit or evidence in support of this position. My answers are three. First of all, I think this is a little hyper-technical by the trial court in these circumstances. Certainly, you can rely on what Rule 56 says, but in these circumstances, I think it's elevating form over function. Second, if it's true that Mr. Mitchell should have provided an affidavit and didn't, that's just another example of his arguable negligence, and I think another reason why the trial court should have brought everybody in and ascertained what was really going on.
Counsel, let me ask you about that. It seems to me that at bottom your argument is essentially that because counsel was negligent, the request for admission shouldn't be deemed admitted. But isn't there some negligence involved in any situation where a party's attorney hasn't timely responded to requests for admissions?
Sure.
So you would always set aside, you would always give more time. There would never be these deemed admissions.
I don't think that's accurate, Your Honor. I think the trial court has an obligation to evaluate the circumstances and evaluate where you are in the litigation process, evaluate the context of the case, and evaluate, most importantly, the prejudice to the city, which is something I'll get to in a moment. And I think the case law is very clear that what the trial court did here, I think, was in essence focus on Mr. Mitchell's lack of a persuasive answer to the trial court why he didn't respond timely. But especially the federal case law cited in the Sanchez opinion is very clear that you must look at the effect of the prejudice on the non-moving party as it relates to going to trial, not the excuse or lack of excuse for why the admissions weren't provided. But my deeper point about Mr. Mitchell's negligence is that that was the reason the trial court should have had a red flag, if you will, and brought everybody in to evaluate what was really going on because of this reason, Your Honor, which is there was no findings whether or not the client actually got the discovery. Regardless of whether Mr. Mitchell actually got the discovery or not, I think it's unfair to dismiss the case for the client if the attorney is not believed by the trial court. And in that circumstance, I think the trial court should query Mr. Mitchell what really happened, and on some level query the client, were you aware of this? Were you enabling this behavior? Were you innocent of this behavior? And based on that finding, interplay, whatever you want to call it, then appropriately move forward.
I guess what I'm troubled by is this notion that counsel for the other side and the court itself has to kind of take up the slack when the other side's attorney is negligent, that they have to step in and kind of do the other attorney's job for him. And that seems to me what you're suggesting. It seems to me, though, that a client is responsible for the negligent acts of its attorney, and if there are negligent acts, then there perhaps is a remedy against that attorney. But the other side and the court don't have any obligation to step in and save the client from the attorney.
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor, especially as related to the court. And I know in practice, and I imagine many attorneys can tell you, there are many instances where you sort of have to do the job of the other side because that's what I think our system of justice requires. We're officers of the court, as well as counsel responsible to our client. And even though that's a dual role and may seem conflicting, I think the obligations of the system to ensure that substantial justice is done is paramount. And even if you're not willing to put that burden on counsel, you certainly need to put that burden on the trial court.
But the trial court is supposed to be a neutral arbiter. It's not supposed to take sides. It's not supposed to be an advocate for a party.
That's why the trial court should have a hearing and find out what's going on. I think, for example, you could read the Grindberg case as the trial court essentially saying, look, on some level, I think the client is participating in these bad acts, for a simple phrase. And in the Moses case, the Supreme Court eventually said, you know, the client was essentially innocent. So those are two appellate examples where I think both this court, the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court is respectfully disagreeing with your position, Your Honor, that at the end of the day, even though the trial court is neutral, their job is to make sure that everybody has their day in court and has a fair opportunity to present their case, especially on the merits, if it's warranted. And if you want to fast forward to the end, I think that's what happened here. There was a rush to judgment, and at least the defendants and the appellants on appeal did not get their day in court. And it was the trial court's job, as there was a hearing held in both Moses and Grindberg, you know, to figure out what was really going on. And I think those two factors are what require reversal and remand here, is A, there was a rush to judgment, and B, there was a lack of findings in the record, whether by hearing or otherwise, to determine what was really going on.
Mr. Lilly, could I ask you a question?
Of course.
If there had been a hearing and there is a presumption that the discovery was sent out and was received, what is the evidence that would have been presented at the hearing?
I don't know, Your Honor, because there was no record there, but I presume that Mr. Mitchell would have expanded on what he said, that he never got it. And his reasons for that may or may not have been credible, but I guess what troubles me at the end of the day is that there were no findings on whether or not what he had to say was credible. And I guess the deeper question to me becomes, if he got it or was presumed to have got it, then the question becomes, was the client ever actually on notice of that? And there was no findings on that either by the trial court. And honestly, when I look at this record, that's what troubles me the most. If I can move quickly, because I'm running out of time, as is always the case, to the prejudice issue. I just want to say, first of all, that this is a second presumption made by the trial court. So she's building on the presumption of receipt with the presumption of prejudice. And I honestly think that to say that because the discovery deadline was July 7th and there was a quest of July 8th, which is only 11 days, with a trial date of September 5th, to say that that is too late in the procedure beyond the discovery cutoff. I mean, I've had many cases where discovery goes right up until the trial date. So the idea that the trial court couldn't have allowed the discovery to be filed, and then if there was or was not prejudice based on those answers, acted appropriately to protect the city going to trial either by instructions or, well, this was a trial to the court. So, you know, there were plenty of options for the trial court to allow the discovery to happen.
Mr. Lilly, my understanding is that not only did Telecom and Mr. Wright not respond to the request for admission, they didn't respond to other discovery that had been sent by the city. Is that correct?
That is correct. And, so, and also, there were no Rule 26 disclosures filed by Mr. Mitchell either, Your Honor.
So doesn't that go into the prejudice calculus, because the city didn't have responses to interrogatories, then it had less information than it would have had otherwise in order to determine its prepare for trial.
Certainly that is a distinguishing factor, and that especially in the Moses case, there were Rule 26 disclosures made, and if I'm correct, there were not Rule 26 disclosures made in the Greinberg case. But here's the answer to your question, Your Honors, is that, first of all, it's the city's burden to prove prejudice. And what I think the trial court did is essentially presume prejudice in a circular way. And here's how she did this. She said, first of all, they sent the discovery, so you must have got it, you being Mr. Mitchell. And since you got it, Mr. Mitchell, and you failed to answer, this equals prejudice because it causes delay. So it's a presumption built upon a presumption based on this discovery cutoff idea. And then, because I'm running out of time quickly, the third presumption she made is, if you look at the questions and they're in her order, number 6 and 7, there's no identification of the date at issue. So the trial court filled in the blank and essentially assumed that they were appropriately regarding the date at issue regarding ownership. So to stack this presumption on top of a presumption on top of a presumption with no opportunity to rebut it, when it's the city's burden to prove prejudice. And I think also quickly, if you look at the case law, especially the federal case law cited in the reply brief that's cited in the Sanchez versus Moosberger case, it clearly talks about the reliance on admissions for summary judgment and mere lack of discovery is not the prejudice that the rule contemplates. The rule contemplates your lack of ability to prove your case at trial. And that's what I'm saying. I think the trial court, you know, should have allowed the discovery, and then once it happened, then evaluated what is the appropriate remedy for the city at that point. So to again, to fast forward, she kind of rushed to judgment, and by rushing to judgment, you know, she denied the defendants their day in court. And just to conclude, I want to say real briefly on the constitutional issues. I think the point there simply is that there's a lot of record, a lot of lack of a complete record, it raises questions about the underlying due process issues in the administrative hearing. And I think these are material issues of law and fact that need to be developed in the record on remand when this case is sent back to the trial court.
Counsel, before you leave, I realize you're out of time, but I think we can grant a little extension. On this issue about how the city was supposed to address and disprove your defenses, I'm not aware of any law that supports that. They moved for summary judgment saying, here are the elements of our claim. Here are the facts that are undisputed that relate to those elements. We are entitled to relief. And then it seems to me it's not their burden to disprove affirmative defenses or defenses. Then it's the defendant's burden to come forward with something showing that there is a defense. But you seem to be suggesting in your briefs and here today that the city had some obligation to refute all possible defenses to its motion.
Well, I think for summary judgment to stand, they should. And I think even if you don't think that that's the city's burden, I think it's certainly the court's burden to evaluate the record and see what's there. And again, that's another reason in my mind why she should have had a hearing to query Mr. Mitchell what's going on. You know, and she even points out, I think it's in footnote 5 of her order, that Mr. Mitchell, you know, didn't raise any of these issues and only argued that the omissions should be withdrawn and not deemed admitted. And I guess on one level, I was trying to point out to this body, to this court, similar to a Rule 55, that because I think it really in essence is a default judgment, that there are issues of material fact and law that should have been argued that weren't and that should be argued on remand on below. And I guess the secondary issue is that that was another reason why the trial court should have been on guard, if you will, to make sure that the defendant's rights were being adequately protected, given Mr. Mitchell's conduct. I don't think anybody could honestly look at this record and walk away without the idea that on some level, Mr. Mitchell's conduct fell below the standard of care. And if that's the case, I don't think that trial court should sit idly by and just allow that to happen if they have an opportunity to bring everybody in and make sure that the right thing is being done by the parties at the end of the day. And I guess that's really my point, Your Honor, is it goes back to there was a rush to judgment and that the parties need their substantial day in court.
Thank you, Mr. Lilly.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is James Kaplan, registration 7741 on behalf of the plaintiff FLE, City and County of Denver.
Excuse me, before you get started, I'd like to ask the bailiff to give Mr. Kaplan an extra 2 minutes because we gave extra time to Mr. Lilly. You're not obligated to use the extra 2 minutes, but you have it if you so desire.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I wanted to start off following up on Mr. Lilly's last comments with regard to the issue of the constitutional issues. And in particular, because this argument didn't occur until the reply brief with regard to this ex post facto issue of when these ordinances were adopted. And in the reply brief, the defendants note that two of the critical sections, Denver Revised Municipal Code 2-294 was passed in 2008, and that section 10-142 was passed in October of 2012, and both those dates are correct. And effectively, they are saying these are ex post facto laws that affect the defendant's interest in these subject properties. And they also say that the application of section 10-142 in the order for summary judgment is an ex post facto application. But I want to point out to the court that ex post facto law under Colorado law is specifically bifurcated into two potential concepts, one being retroactive law and one being retrospective law. And retroactive law is not prohibited by the Colorado Constitution, only laws that are retrospective. And this is laid out in City of Golden versus Parker. It's at 138 Pacific 3rd, 285, Colorado Supreme Court, 2006, and refers to Colorado Constitution Article 2, Section 11. And then it's broken down into a two-part sequence. The first step is to determine whether the law is intended to operate retroactively. And citing FICARA versus Department of Regulatory Agencies, That's at 849 Pacific Second 6. That's Colorado Supreme Court, 1993. And in FICARA, the court specifically found that no express language of retroactive intent is necessary. And the court in Parker also cited In Re Estate of DeWitt, which is found at 54 Pacific 3rd, 849. That's the Colorado Supreme Court in 2002. And Kuhn versus State at 924 Pacific 2nd, 1053. That's Colorado Supreme Court, 1996. None of these cases are cited in the briefs because this issue did not come up until the reply brief was filed. The court in DeWitt found that retroactive application of a statute is not necessarily unconstitutional. It is permitted where the statute affects a change that is procedural or remedial. And I'll get into the history of these ordinances that will show that it's evident that retroactive application of the 2008 and 2012 amendments was intended, because the amendments only changed the procedure by which the enforcement of penalties and liens, which had been created actually in 1998, before the defendants took title to the property, existed before these amendments were put into place. And then the second step is to determine whether the retroactively applied law operates retrospectively. And retrospective operation means that a later law impairs vested rights acquired under existing laws or creates a new obligation with respect to those transactions. That also comes from the Inouye DeWitt case and the City of Golden versus Parker case. Then there's a three-part test to determine if a right is vested: whether the public interest is advanced or retarded, whether the statute defeats the reasonable expectations of affected individuals, and whether the statute surprises individuals who have relied on a contrary law. And ultimately, even if there is retroactive application considered, it's not dispositive, because that effect can be balanced against public health and safety concerns and the state's police powers to regulate certain practices. Again, those rules are laid out in City of Golden. There are additional cases: Miller versus Brannon, 207 Pacific 3rd, 923. That's Colorado Court of Appeals, 2009. Greystone Construction versus National Fire, that's 661 Fed 3rd, 1272. That's the 10th Circuit from 2011. And then finally, In Re Rivera, 513 Bankruptcy Reporter 742. That's from the Bankruptcy Court, District of Colorado, in 2014. And I bring those cases up because they've not been cited in the briefs, and it shows that this trend in the law has continued literally until just last year. Now, here the city ordinances do involve public health and safety concerns and do bear a rational relationship to a legitimate government interest, that is, protecting the city from neglected and derelict buildings and protecting the public health and safety. And if we review the history of these ordinances, the court will find that almost identical provisions with regard to the penalties, the enforcement procedure, and the liens that result from these penalties existed in 1998, so that the retroactive application of the amendments in 2008 and 2012 do not impair vested rights, vested property rights that Telecom had.
Mr. Kaplan?
Yes.
The trial court never ruled on this issue, correct?
Correct.
So we have nothing to review on that issue?
There's no record on this whatsoever. The reason I'm raising it is the appellant raised this in their reply brief, so there's no record on this at all. That is true. This is purely legal, so it may be that I don't know, since it wasn't raised at the trial court, it may not be the purview of this court to consider that. But once this issue came up in the appellant's reply brief, and nothing had been put forth to addressing it, I felt the need to bring this to the court's attention. If you look at the archives in the Supreme Court Library, there are books maintained in the library that actually trace this history. And the court will find that these penalties, this $990 per day for violation, were actually created in 1998. It's in supplement number 58 and you can find this as a book called Loose Leaf Supplement Instruction Sheets, and it's in supplement 58.
So, and Mr. Kaplan, if I may interrupt you, could you focus on Telecom's main argument regarding the judgment against it based upon the deemed requests for admission.
Sure, I can do that.
And in particular, its argument that it was basically blindsided because Mr. Mitchell said we never got to discovery.
Sure, I can do that. One of my concerns is that the court, I think, appropriately pointed out that there was no affidavit, and the city finds that very troubling. Why was there no affidavit? And the rule does require that there was an affidavit, and in the cases that are routinely cited, including in Utah, rather the defendant's site, People versus Buscarello, there was an affidavit filed about the service.
But by the same token, I don't believe that the city indicated in its motion for summary judgment that it had conferred with Mr. Mitchell before filing the motion.
That is true. The city had not. I don't think conferring is required for a dispositive motion like a rule for summary judgment. I think, in fact, Rule 121 specifically keeps a Rule 56 motion out of the obligation to confer. This was not a motion to compel discovery. It was indeed a motion for summary judgment. So I don't think there is an obligation to confer. With regard to not conferring, as the court noted earlier, there already was a history in the case of the failure of the defendants to respond to discovery and a continuing sequence of extensions of time pushing the case further and further along without moving forward and getting to a resolution. And when we get to the point where the second set of discovery is served and there's no response, I think it was appropriate for the plaintiff to simply move for summary judgment based upon the deemed admissions. And there was no obligation to confer, to go through another round of conferring.
So, counsel, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Did the city do anything after they did not receive the discovery responses?
No, there's no conferring.
Nothing.
Happy to advise, to acknowledge to the court. By then, again, because there had been already multiple rounds of conferring and multiple extensions in the earlier sequence of discovery, the city simply moved for summary judgment based on the deemed admissions. And I do note that even after the motion for summary judgment gets filed, there's still no timely response. It's only after the time expires that we finally do get a response, and the response is, can we file a response to the motion for summary judgment untimely, and can we have more time to respond to discovery? And now what's happening is that the city had planned on having discovery responses due 4 months before trial to use that information, and that time is being whittled away by requests for extensions. And I want to go back to one of the comments made by the court earlier, which is the city should not have to try to guess at what every possible permutation is of the defenses raised in the answer. That's what discovery is for. Let's get to the real chase. What's really behind the defenses raised in the answer? Not the city having to guess at every possible issue that might be raised under an Eighth Amendment legal argument, and guess at every possible way that the defendants might raise a claim that the excessive fines clause is involved. Why should a plaintiff have to guess at what the underlying basis is for the defendant's answers?
Counsel, I want to go
Yes.
back to the question about the affidavit. The trial court seemed to think an affidavit regarding the admissions was required by Rule 56. My concern is that withdrawal of deemed admissions is governed by Rule 36, and there's no requirement in that rule for an affidavit, and I don't understand how we can engraft an affidavit requirement from Rule 56 over to Rule 36 merely because this was a motion for summary judgment. It seems to me they can argue this kind of in two parts. They can knock out the deemed requests, okay? And once they do that, they can say, and therefore you're not entitled to summary judgment. But I just don't know where this affidavit requirement's coming from here.
Well, I can tell you that I appreciate the court's concern. The position that the city took and the position that the trial court took was that Rule 56 does require it, and that was the basis for the ruling. And
But why? Why does it require it? Rule 36 specifically governs withdrawal of requests for admissions to requests for admissions.
Yes.
And it doesn't contain an affidavit requirement. The mailbox rule doesn't contain an affidavit requirement. So in other words, had you not filed a motion for summary judgment, and this had come up in some other contexts, clearly there would be no affidavit requirement to at least put this issue, rebut the presumption to the extent that it becomes then a factual issue.
Yes, and that's certainly a fair assessment, Your Honor. I think that if we look at the trial court's ruling, the ruling was not based entirely on the lack of an affidavit with regard to receiving the discovery request, but the trial court also specifically noted that there had been no effort to respond to the request for admissions, no indication at all that any of them would be denied, no inkling of what the real facts were that were going to be disputed if ultimately responses to the request for admissions were provided. And in that regard, the trial court was not relying on the lack of an affidavit. The trial court was relying on no indication from the defendants that any of the requests for admissions would be denied. And that in addition, the time extension that the defendants requested was beyond the discovery cutoff, beyond the dispositive motion date cutoff, and was not based upon a requirement of an affidavit.
Well, counsel, how do you respond to Mr. Lilly's argument that the district court might have jumped the gun a little on the prejudice inquiry, and it might have been better to let them file the responses and then determine whether or not there wouldn't have been any denials. Maybe they would have admitted it, or at least admitted a lot of it, and then you could assess what the prejudice would be.
Yes, I mean, it's a fair question, Your Honor. My concern would be that as the clock is ticking, we're getting closer and closer to a trial date. At what point should the plaintiff have the benefit of the discovery responses that had been due 2 months prior, and there's no inkling of a response? So I appreciate that even if the responses had been filed late, now we're still in proceedings to determine whether or not they should be allowed. And as the clock continues to tick, we get closer and closer to the trial date, the plaintiff is disadvantaged and prejudiced by its ability to use the discovery responses, which should have been provided 2 months prior, to prepare for trial without having to guess what those defenses were going to be. So it does continue to eat away at the time that, in fact, the parties together bargained for, which was 63 days before the trial. We're seeing that time frame progressively eroded and putting the plaintiff at a progressively more disadvantaged position. Yes.
Mr. Kaplan, my recollection is that in his response to the motion for summary judgment, Mr. Mitchell did not make any assertion of the extent to which the defendants would admit the requests for admission that had been promulgated. Is that consistent with your understanding?
He made no representation, that's right. Either way, that's right. With regard to the defendant's continued reliance on whether or not the court could have held a hearing, and Your Honor, the possibility of that, sure, could have been done. But here again, we have this sequence of time eroding the opportunity of the plaintiff to prepare, and we still have no indication of any kind what the defendants are going to do. We also have a history of the defendants failing to respond and seeking additional extensions of time, ultimately filing an amended answer and requiring the trial to be continued. So now we're on the second round of this sequence of extensions. And in Moses, at least there had been some indication about what the responses were going to be. There had been actually some discovery responses submitted, and here there's nothing. So the trial court judge in this case sees that there's no indication whatsoever of what the defendants are going to do, and now the discovery cutoff is passed, the city contends that it's appropriate for the judge to end the sequence and enter a summary judgment based upon deemed admissions. I also want to point out that even, this issue about whether or not the request for admissions were received, even if we assume that we don't need an affidavit to raise that issue, we've got this issue of, why were they mailed? I didn't receive the mail. Well, when the motion for summary judgment was served electronically, Mr. Mitchell also claimed he didn't get that, claimed that his computer had malfunctioned and didn't have access to it. And then even if you follow his somewhat sketchy timeline about exactly what had gone on while his computer wasn't working, we ultimately get to a point, and this was briefed in our submissions to the court, there's still no explanation. Another 2 weeks goes by. with no explanation of any kind about why there's no response, why there's a delay in responding to summary judgment, why there's no effort to respond to discovery, even assuming that Mr. Mitchell's comments, not sworn affidavit, but his comments that the discovery hadn't been received, even if you assume that to be true, we still have one more indicia of the indication from the defendants that they didn't receive even electronic files. And with regard to the Mr. Lilly's comments with regard to the defendants, if Mr. Mitchell hadn't received these, at least there should have been some indication that the defendants had received these. If the court reviews the record, the court will see that originally the defendants sought to proceed without counsel, which the plaintiff objected to and claimed was inappropriate because we have a limited liability company as one of the defendants. And indeed, the trial court judge struck the answer because they didn't have an attorney and required them to get an attorney. And that was how that's how the case continued to proceed. So to go through that process and then to suggest that now the defendants have been required to get an attorney to be represented, and now the plaintiff is obligated to make sure that discovery requests are given directly to the defendants, certainly runs counter to the requirement the defendants have an attorney.
Mr. Kaplan, your time is up.
Very good. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you again, Mr. Lilly. Thank you, Mr. Kaplan. We appreciate both of your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. As I mentioned at the outset,